Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'm going to be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the stories making the news in business and politics here in Ireland and around the world. And coming up on today's show, the ethical questions around artificial intelligence are looked at in a new book, and we've got its author, Nell Watson, joining us later in the show. And as Eamon Ryan exits politics, we looked at his legacy beyond the environmental issues that he's championed, and we're going to be examining how he's affected rail, roads, airports and energy policy. Daniel McConnell is the editor of the Business Post. He'll be here with his views. And then this. It's the company behind The Godfather, Indiana Jones and Titanic. Over its 98-year history, Paramount Pictures has survived the arrival of Talking Pictures, bankruptcy, the Depression, the rise of TV and multiple owners. The question now is whether the last major studio left in Hollywood can survive the streaming era. If you want to get in contact with us, you can email takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. And we're going to start with that issue in Hollywood today, because if it was a movie script, the plot would involve a once great star on the verge of a glorious comeback, only to have it taken away by what? Well, that's the question that's posed by both entertainment insiders and market analysts who've been trying to make sense of exactly what's going on at Paramount Pictures after the collapse of a lucrative takeover deal which could have brought them back into the limelight. Well, one person who's been following the story is Justin Clowens from The Week in the US, and he joins me on the line. Justin, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Hi, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, lots of our listeners will recognise Paramount as Paramount Plus on their digital skybox or something. But let's go way, way back to the good old days of Paramount Pictures. Just remind us how big a studio this was in its heyday and exactly what they owned.
Well, it was a huge studio. It's one of the original Hollywood studios. They're actually the only Hollywood studio left that still has their main picture lot in Los Angeles. And as you said, they were huge. They owned CBS, Viacom. They still do. And they were responsible for franchises like Top Gun, Mission Impossible, and some of the biggest movies of the last few decades.
So they were a big, big production house. They were a big, big movie company. Where did it all start to go wrong for them?
Well, in 2019, they re-merged with Viacom, which is a company that they had split from in 2005. And that was seen as quite a shock in Hollywood because they were a major player in the industry. And they had been losing money for a while, but they re-merged with Viacom CBS in 2019 to eventually become a company called Paramount Global. And the woman at that top of that right now is a woman called Sherry Redstone. She's the chairwoman of Paramount Global. Her father, Sumner, was the person who originally acquired Viacom in 1987. He owned a company called National Amusements. And Paramount has been having a lot of financial issues for years. And obviously the writer's strike and the overall Hollywood turmoil that was seen last year was kind of a final nail in the coffin for them. Subscriptions for cable at CBS have been falling. The ad market in Hollywood has been on the downswing for a long time. So they've kind of just been looking for a lifeline. And that's where a lot of these looking for a deal started to come from.
Yeah, and I was looking at some of the figures there, Justin. The value of the company was something like $8 billion, but the debt in the company was $14 billion. So against that backdrop, they're out there looking for someone to come and help them. Where was the knight? Mm-hmm. Who was the knight who came in shining armor to do just that?
Yeah, well, as you said, they've been losing value for a long time. Their shares have actually dropped 65% since they re-merged with Viacom in 2019. And they had a few other offers throughout this year. A company called Apollo Management gave them an offer at $11 billion. Sony and Apollo made a joint offer. But the main offer that looked like it was going to go through was from a company called Skydance, which is led by David Ellison, It's not one of the major Hollywood studios, but it is very well known within the industry. It's collaborated with almost all of the major studios. And that deal looked like it was going to go through. It was a deal that was valued at $8 billion. And basically, Skydance would buy out about half of Paramount shares. Sherry Redstone, the chairwoman, would get about $2 billion. Hmm. And that was the deal as it stood up until a few weeks ago.
And tell me a little bit more about David Ellison. Why do you think that the Paramount deal was an attractive one for him personally?
Well, he's a very well-known film producer, and he's the son of Larry Ellison. And Skydance Media has been looking to increase their profile for a long time. And they've also worked with Paramount before. In 2009, they entered into a partnership to produce films with Paramount. And for Ellison, this seemed like the most logical way for him to keep growing Skydance's profile.
Did he think that he had a particular solution to tackle the streaming wing of the company's challenges? You mentioned there that they were struggling to get back from the Hollywood strikes, and obviously the cable lost subs in America is huge, but also they're losing hand over fist to other big offerings. I think Netflix is three times as much subscribers or as many subscribers as them. So did he feel that he could tackle that at that wing of the business and the company?
That was certainly part of it. As you said, Paramount Plus, that company's streaming service, is right now fifth among the major streamers. They have 71.2 million subscribers. Netflix has 269 million. So as you mentioned, more than three times Paramount Plus. So that was definitely something that Ellison and Skydance were looking to potentially help out the company with.
It's interesting, isn't it, Justin, that they're both children of, you know, people who had made their own companies successful and kind of hanging on to these businesses. I want to start looking, if I can, Justin, at what went wrong then. So these two people come together. He's offering a solution to her massive amount of problems to make it all great again. Where did it all go wrong?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that they're both the children of people who are at the helm of these legacy media companies, because a lot of insiders feel that that is kind of where things started to go wrong, because Sherry Redstone simply didn't want to part with the company that her father has been in control of for so long. Her father passed away in 2020. But the Redstones have been at the head of National Amusements, which owns Paramount Global, for decades now. And a lot of insiders just thought that she simply wasn't ready to part with them. But there were others that said that she wasn't happy with the finances of the deal, and that she wasn't happy with the fact that she would only get about $2 billion. One source told The Wrap, which is a Hollywood inside outlet, that she just basically wanted to get as much money as possible for herself. And at the end of the day, she, according to sources, is basically the one that single-handedly axed the deal.
It's all becoming very like the plot line in that hugely successful, I think it was HBO program Succession, or maybe it was Sky, where the family ultimately becomes the big thing. And she herself is a very interesting character. She had to face a lot of challenges to just simply take over the company with other executives and even her father's former wives and stuff. So do you think that, where does this actually leave her now with the problems? She still has the debt. Those other suitors that you mentioned from before, are any of those likely to take up where Skydance have failed?
Well, as you said, the company is still dealing with significant problems. And a lot of the people within Paramount were completely blindsided by this. I mean, especially since the financials of the deal to merge with Skydance were basically all set in stone. And at the last minute, it completely fell apart. So it's hard to say where necessarily Paramount goes from here. After the deal fell through, their CEOs, they have three combined CEOs, George Cheeks, Brian Robbins, and Chris McCarthy. They put out a message to Paramount employees saying that They were going to be transforming their streaming strategy and trying to streamline the organization and try and reduce costs, basically, as much as possible. And what a lot of insiders are taking that to mean is that there may not be a deal for Paramount to merge with another company in the foreseeable future.
Mm. And then just in that scenario, what do you think happens?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people are thinking, particularly insiders in the industry, that Paramount is likely to go it alone, at least for the foreseeable future. Companies in Hollywood may not necessarily be eager to jump into this battle right now, especially after seeing how the deal with Paramount and Skydance fell apart. What's also likely to happen is that there could be kind of a battle between the other major studios that own streaming services to try and license Paramount's content or create some kind of deal with Paramount Plus to where they could stream Paramount's content on their own platforms.
Mm. It's a sad story, really. I mean, I know these people are tremendously wealthy behind it all, but it does. It's a Hollywood crown jewel, if you like. It's historic. It has that iconic lot on Melrose Avenue, and it's got the big library of old film. And you know, it's a shame to see, you know, that this is what might happen. A company like this gets maybe perhaps broken off and sold to the highest bidder just for a streaming service. Maybe it's just the evolution of an industry like that, but I guess it's something you've been watching for a long time. Do you think that that's the way it's going to go? We'll have no more of those Hollywood iconic brands left?
Well, there certainly seems to be at least partially the trend. Paramount, if they were to merge, would not be the first ones within Hollywood to do this recently. There have been a lot of companies. Warner Brothers was spun off of AT&T and Discovery to create Warner Brothers Discovery. Sony has recently been looking to buy other properties as well. As a matter of fact, they actually just purchased a theater chain called the Alamo Drafthouse, which is in the United States. So this era of kind of mergers and acquisitions has been going on for a while in Hollywood.
Mm.
And Paramount saga is just the latest.
Yeah. Justin Clowens from The Week US, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Now, would you be happy letting your loved one drive off in a driverless car? Well, the ethics of AI are discussed in a new book, and its author, Nell Watson, joins me after the break. Now, you're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. And now it's time for this.
Techscape on Taking Stock. Brought to you by PwC. Our industry experts can help you unlock the full potential of AI to transform your business safely and responsibly. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
Artificial intelligence has been bubbling under computing for a very long time, I think. But with the advent of ChatGPT and the promise of things like self-driving cars, it's kind of burst through into the public consciousness in a much more prevalent way. And we all readily accept that there's enormous possibilities for AI to help improve our lives. But how ethical will artificial intelligence be? Well, my next guest has written widely on the subject, and her new book is called Taming the Machine, Ethically Harnessed the Power of AI. And she's here now to discuss how we might live alongside AI ethically. Nell Watson, you're very welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock.
Thank you, Mandy. It's a pleasure to join you.
Now, Nell, I know that this is an area that you have been working on and examining for years and years and years, looking at emerging technologies and how we protect human rights within those emerging technologies. But what was your main goal in writing this book?
Well, I've been operating in the space of AI for well over 10 years. I first established a company doing machine vision, which is basically helping computers to understand pictures and videos and things like that and to recognize objects in them. So I had a body measurement company which could take the measurements of a person from nothing more than a couple of pictures of them and a whole bunch of patents related to that. That company is actually still going. It's now based in New York. But having helped to further the space of AI, I started to feel a sense of responsibility towards it. I have been an evangelist for the opportunities of AI for many years, but gradually I also began to become more concerned about how things were going in terms of the governance of these technologies. Mm. And that's why I sought to distill all of the knowledge that I've gained in terms of how to use AI more responsibly in terms of ethics such as transparency, bias, and governance. And this new emerging area of safety as well, which is particularly important for a new class of models called agentic systems. And those are going to be enormously more capable than generative AI has been.
Hmm. So what or when, Nell, did you start to kind of think, hang on here, you know, the pace of this change means that we are moving a little bit too fast and we don't have maybe the regulatory processes alongside the advancement of the technology? Is it that kind of parallel development of regulation, governance with the speed of the emerging technologies that they just were going in two different directions?
Exactly, yes. Governance is typically done in the rearview mirror. Mm. That's usually after you've already driven over something and you're like, uh-oh, what was that? it means that typically there's a gap of at least 2 years minimum before some new technology or cultural development or security issue has arisen that regulators can begin to step in and put things right. Mm. Unfortunately, 2 years in AI is a heck of a long time. It's only been about 1.5 years since the advent of ChatGPT. And of course, that has revolutionized the world now that the public has woken up to these very powerful new technologies. Mm. And unfortunately, it's only going to get faster from here. The next generation of technologies are agentic models, which are able to form sophisticated plans in response to complex problems, acting like a concierge who's able to help you to plan an event or to make sense out of a messy project with hundreds of different documents, or indeed to understand what's going on in the whole landscape of an organization.
Mm.
These models, however, because they're at arm's length, because we're managing them by objectives, makes it much more difficult to have oversight over them. Mm. They can begin to do things independently without our action or knowledge. Sometimes these models even act deceptively. They can swear blind that they've done something or that they've seen something when they haven't. And that's why we're now getting into this zone of AI safety, of trying to teach our values to these machines, and importantly, our preferences and our boundaries as well. And that's why I'm so happy that Taming the Machine covers both those ethical and safety aspects, because they're generally not spoken of in the same breath.
Mm. So let's now look at some of the real world examples of something like that and an application of this agentic system, which is, you know, the next iteration of AI as we will maybe see it in our lives. So let's say we have an autonomous vehicle and it's faced with a choice of moving along a road and hitting one old man on the side of the street or hitting a woman with a pram with a number of children. Are we talking about programs that will make the machine have the capacity to decide in those scenarios where there's no human intervention, not acquired, but built in?
In essence, similar kinds of issues, yes, but it won't necessarily involve things such as life and death. It might involve a system deciding that having been given a mission to plan a picnic, that it decides to give everyone a shot glass of tap water and a cracker, and that will suffice, right? Because it's fulfilling its mission, it's getting its little sense of reward from doing so, but it's done so obviously in the most lazy and simple manner. Similarly, if that picnic is for the local synagogue or mosque or vegan society, giving everyone ham sandwiches is not going to be preferred by them either. And that's why it's so important for machines to learn the context in which they're operating and the preferences of not just those who are giving them missions to go and fulfill, but actually those who will be affected downstream by that. And that's a very difficult thing to ask and typical user to deal with. It takes a lot of education, takes a lot of preparation. We should never set an AI system off on a mission without telling it exactly what would fulfill that mission in a very careful definition. Or indeed things which would create force majeure that would frustrate the fulfillment of that mission. If we don't follow these kinds of practices, we can end up with systems that run away from us and really get the wrong end of the stick and do things that we do not expect because of the shortcuts that they've taken or the ways in which they've misinterpreted the broader goals of what we are trying to achieve.
And Nell, do you think that that's happening, that there's AI systems or agentic systems that are now being created that give instruction, but not necessarily moral autonomy, but that could allow machines to kind of go off and make decisions that continue a program on, maybe perhaps beyond where the original creation had intended it to go?
Absolutely. In fact, all the big tech companies now have these agentic models. They're kind of sitting on them for the moment. They haven't been introduced to the public yet. In the same way that generative AI has been around for many years before ChatGPT, but ChatGPT was the moment where the public kind of realized in this Sputnik-like moment that we had entered a new age. And we are about to see another similar moment with agentic AI where the public realized just how capable machines have become. And that will be probably the instigator of a moral panic within society as many people flail about and wonder what this means for their job or for society at large. We are in for a rough ride, at least in the shorter term. I think in the longer term, we will start to make sense of this stuff and figure it out. I liken it to air travel, jet air travel in the 1940s and 50s, which was a very glamorous affair, you know, very expensive affair at times, but also sometimes a tragic one. You know, we had to make unfortunate mistakes along that journey, but we learned from it quickly. And we developed, you know, the flight recorders and cockpit voice recorders and sterile cockpit rules and things like that that helped to ensure that air travel became statistically the safest way to travel. And I think we'll have a similar journey with AI, a bit of a rough ride for a few years, but eventually with enough governance and enough public education, I think we'll make sense of it in due course.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Most of us understand that this is something that can add to our lives and that there's huge potential for us all in our everyday lives, one way or another. There is that fear about the replacement of jobs and stuff. But I think, as you say, we're just in the very infancy of this. I think where the fear comes in, and fear is the wrong word, but is we know that there's the possibility for this to be great in our lives. We just don't know how to harness that greatness and use it. And in the book, which I just want to give the name again, it's called Taming the Machine, Ethically Harness the Power of AI. What you try to do, as I see it, is to suggest a way that we can live alongside AI while we're ironing out those chinks. But those moral questions and that period of time that you're talking about now where we might have a bit of pushback against it. What's your antidote to solving these problems?
I think that we need to help regulators as much as possible to be as proactive as they can, to not react to something which has arisen, because by the time that they've reacted to it, you know, we're in a different world, technology's moved on, new cultural changes have arisen. And that's why I think it's important that we embed a little bit of science fiction into how we create policy for technology, that we consider the near future developments and that we try to make sense of those risks as they begin to emerge before they're fully blown. I think most regulators and policymakers haven't learned to do that yet. I think it's going to be essential as we collectively grapple with AI as a global society.
Well, now, look, that's a fascinating insight into the advancement of this AI and the next iteration of it. The book is called Taming the Machine, Ethically Harness the Power of AI. And that was his author, Nell Watson. Nell, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Mandy. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Coming up, it's not easy being green as Eamon Ryan takes his leave. We look at his legacy beyond the green agenda. We'll be right back with Daniel McConnell from The Business Post after this short break. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, for our final item today, take a listen to this.
I'm stepping down to pass the torch to a new generation of leaders, confident in the strength and values I've seen built up in our party over all these years.
That was, of course, the unmistakable voice of Eamon Ryan. After first taking office 25 years ago, Eamon Ryan announced this week that he would be stepping down as leader of the Green Party. He would also not be contesting the next general election. Now, we've heard lots and lots this week about his legacy and the Green Party legacy and his success in environmental terms, in terms of what he's done in government and in government policy. But when it comes to the likes of infrastructure and energy and utilities, what has he and the Greens actually managed to achieve in that time? Well, I'm joined now by Daniel McConnell, who is editor of The Business Post. Danny, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Mandy. Good to talk to you.
Now, Danny, I think one of the things that struck me this week about Eamon Ryan was remembering that he learned a lot from his last time in government. And it seemed to me that entering government this time, he decided, look, I'm not just going into office. I realise that I am going into power. And that in their first negotiations in the programme for government in 2020, this time, he was going to assert that power. So in some ways, and I want to kick off with this, I want to examine whether or not you think that there was maybe too much of his imprint on the programme for government from the start, just to get him into the coalition. Because at that time, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil were desperate to put a coalition together. And so maybe in that context, maybe it was a very hard green rubber stamp on the programme for government, and Eamon Ryan knew he had that leverage at that time.
He certainly did, and I think you're absolutely right. And I think from your own time in government, I think you probably would have remembered when the Greens first went in, and it was around the time when I first started reporting on national politics, and I was sort of given the Green beat, and they were badly exposed in that first government. I think, you know, that they weren't aware of the machinery of government. They weren't aware of, I suppose, dealing with a much bigger coalition partner in Fianna Fáil, who had been, you know, obviously at the cabinet table for so many years and decades, and knew every trick in the book. Whereas I think the Eamon Ryan and the Green Party that took to those negotiations in 2020 were far more astute, and they certainly were able to wrangle a far more concrete green agenda out of the two other coalition partners, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. You look at the carbon tax, you look at, you know, the carbon emissions targets, the imposition, I suppose, of real emissions target reductions that were meaningful. They had money committed to it. They had genuine fiscal rectitude associated with it. So it wasn't just tinkering around the edges. This was real policy that had real impact on the day-to-day functioning of government. And, you know, Eamon Ryan has adopted, much to the chagrin of many in Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, has taken a very hardline approach in relation to the development of road projects, even those that were previously committed to. And he's driven an awful lot of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil backbench TDs absolutely crackers, with his insistence that there be a much greater emphasis on public transport. While it's fair to say Bus Connects was not his idea, he has certainly picked up the cudgels of that and run with it very, very vehemently. So I think the imprint of Eamon Ryan will far outlive his time in government. He has certainly become a lightning rod of criticism and controversy, not only, as I said, from within the coalition, but from very notable figures such as Michael O'Leary, the chief executive of the Ryanair Group, and the rural independents. So, I mean, the Greens did become a lightning rod for that criticism. But that's what happens when you try to make change, you're trying to deliver change. You're you're upsetting established cultures and practices and, you know, people's ways of life. And certainly, I think the Green Party have achieved an awful lot, despite the odds and despite their rather small size in government. Now, this is in keeping with, you know, previous experience. We know the Progressive Democrats in government obviously managed to wrangle a pretty sizable price out of the then Fianna Fáil government as well. And their imprint on government policy at that time was pretty clear to see, particularly on kind of economic and taxation policy. So it is, I suppose, you can almost punch above your weight in coalition governments in Ireland, and clearly the Greens can argue very successfully that they have done that in this case.
They surely can. When those parties have a particular strong strain of policy and they go into government, you're right, they can punch above their weights in entering government. But when they get in there, what happens most of the time is that the larger parties then begin to ameliorate their policies a little bit, if you like, to sort, not to dilute them to the extent that they can't see them anymore. But there's a rational, reasonable way to progress through the party's policy. But when they're in government, I suppose, and they're in charge of departments, they're not just responsible for the voters who vote for them. They're responsible for all of us, not just the Green voters. And in that sense, I want to look at the things like the big projects that he very ably managed to get agreement on. Like, his decarbonisation programme is an industrial revolution. It's irreversible. And maybe it will work in terms of helping our targets and reducing global warming. We don't know that yet, but it has massive implications for his government, the coalition government, and for us. And that's beyond the green agenda. So what I wanted to look at today is the implementation of the Greens in government beyond their own policies. How do you think that they've affected government in a business sense?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting question. And I think, you know, a lot of it would stem from the success of getting, say, something like the Climate Action Plan through, which obviously has an impact on every government department, has an impact on every budget line. And so that ultimately has a very direct impact, as I said earlier on, in terms of how, you know, each line minister has to kind of reduce their budget. You know, they now all have to, you know, make allowances for reducing emissions in the budgets that they're putting forward. They have to, obviously, there has to be a sustainability element to what they're putting forward. Like, again, that has real money, cost and time and energy beside it. You know, again, putting something, getting something like the Metro North back on the agenda, like, I mean, that's a major public transport project that was dropped due to austerity reasons over a decade ago. But that's a big win from an Eamon Ryan perspective, because that's a huge concentration of public money into a major public project, which has obviously been much maligned given the delays that affected it. But once that is delivered, and it looks like it now will be delivered, albeit very late and very, very, you know, in some years' time. But that's a legacy that the Greens can genuinely point to, say, we got that done, we put it back on the agenda, and we ultimately were the ones who got that delivered. So I think there are very tangible and real impacts, far beyond Eamon Ryan's core department that he can point to very successfully. I think where they've been less successful, Mandy, I think, and this falls probably more to Catherine Martin, I think they've been far less successful in terms of the media. You know, I think the RTE stuff and the failure to sort of get agreement yet in terms of the future funding of RTE and all of the controversies that have streamed out of RTE of the last year or so are a blot on the Greens' book. And I think one of the major criticisms that have been levelled by their coalition partners to them and by everybody else within Dáil Éireann is that they do come across as a bit preachy, a bit high-handed. They're overly moralistic in terms of, we know better than you, we are the sort of the true disciples of this, you know, cause, and those who are against us are sort of Philistines. That attitude has not won them any favours or won them any plaudits or any friends in government. I would certainly think, you know, there was many people in Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil looking at the fallout of the local and European election saying, let's find another party to do business with after the next election. I think we can do, the two big parties, we can do business together. So is it the Social Democrats? Is it the Labour Party? And we'll probably have an easier run of it. The Greens won't be wrecking our heads with all this stuff, you know, forcing change. So I think those conversations have been going on. But I think the departure of Eamon Ryan, certainly, undoubtedly, whether it's Roderick O'Gorman or Pippa Hackett or whoever succeeds him as leader, the Greens' standing in government will be substantially weakened by the departure of Eamon Ryan from the leader's position. I think his manner of being able to work with both Leo Varadkar and Simon Harris as Taoiseach, and with Micheál Martin, both as Taoiseach and as Taoiseach, I think that has largely helped their success in getting things done. You know, that that three-way government meeting on a Monday night, that clearinghouse meeting, has proven exceptionally important for the workings of this government. Personal relationships are said to be extremely good, and that access essentially has kept the show on the road during some very trying times, particularly during COVID. But I think, you know, with the removal of Eamon Ryan, I think that dynamic is going to change. I do think the two senior partners, the two bigger parties, are lucky to try and maximise and leverage their standing over a much weakened Green Party. And I think that point was reflected across a lot of the commentary in the last few days from across the political spectrum. You may not have agreed with Eamon Ryan, you may not have, you know, bought into his kind of ideology, but very few people, if any, have had any difficulty with how he conducted his business. He seems very much as a substantial politician and one who was able to conduct his business with courtesy and respect, which, in fairness, is a much underrated kind of tribute or facet or attribute in modern politics. So he leaves and exits the stage, I think, with a very fine legacy behind him. The big question from a political, and I'm talking with my political hat on, Mandy, is the reason as to why Catherine Martin, his deputy leader, who seemed to want the job for so long, decided not to go for it. That raises an awful lot more questions around, I suppose, internal Green politics dynamics. But, you know, her decision not to go, I think, you know, further diminished the standing of the Green Party in government, because she's been there as Eamon Ryan's side since 2016.
If you were being terribly cynical, which of course neither of us are, you might think she's maybe sitting this one out and waiting her time to see if there's another spin on this merry-go-round after the next general election. But who knows? Anyway, Danny, I just want to go back to the business end of things, really, and look at some of the issues that your paper has been covering really excellently in recent years, on the wider issue of our economy, and that is the infrastructural supports that we have. So we're an energy poor country. We have one gas operation and one interconnector, and Eamon Ryan, true to his own values, promised to move us to a macro renewable energy form. And to his credit, he brought in the policies to do that. But has he been successful in turning the dial and moving us toward a more renewable, sustainable energy that will replace those traditional fossil fuel energies that we were used to in the past?
I don't think you could say it's probably a qualified success, Mandy, really, in honest, because I don't think we're anywhere near where we need to be in terms of moving that along. I mean, Europe, the United States, everyone looks to Ireland with sort of some envy in terms of the potential capacity of wind energy off our western coast, and it has largely gone untapped up to this point. And so that is ultimately a failure, that things have not progressed sufficiently on that front. However, I think what he has done is try and shape and change people's minds. A bit like the Gareth Fitzgerald, you might not get the policy change or the action changed, but the changing of mindsets, I think, is one of the big legacies I think Eamon Ryan will be praised for in times, in years to come, that he, you know, his insistence on, you know, trying to break the monopoly of imported fossil fuels and looking to alternative forms of energy. I think he's certainly led the way in terms of shaping the conversation. I think what a lot of people will say in terms of the Greens' legacy on this is that a lot of the, you know, when you're looking at, say, something like retrofitting or other things, they never managed to turn the dial sufficiently to remove the upfront cost for an awful lot of people. Like, you know, it's still way too expensive for an awful lot of people to get your solar panels or insulate your homes. The upfront cost just is too prohibitive. But I think what he has done is certainly changed the dial about the conversation. I think another area where he's sought to highlight is electronic vehicles and electric bikes and kind of the cycling, you know, the kind of the alternative modes of transport. Again, he's led the conversation, but I think delivery, you know, they had been target set of, you know, 1 million electric vehicles on the roads of Ireland. Like, we're nowhere near that. But I do think attitudes have changed. And I think Eamon Ryan and the Green Party can take great credit in terms of changing that conversation. You know, electric vehicles are commonplace now.
Last year, though, the figures were in decline last year, and that the targets that they've set out are just, they're nowhere near them. And everybody accepts now that they're just not achievable.
I was going to make that point that, like, there has been a setback in terms of the EV. Kind of, I think the fact you're looking at, you know, electric vehicles coming to the end of their warranty, and you know, there's upfront costs and heavy potential costs for people trying to, and the resale, there's an impact on potential resale value of electric vehicles. So the long-term impact of this is beginning to bite. There's no doubt about it. But I do think there has been a sea change in terms of attitudes around electric cars and electric vehicles. But I think, you know, they were nowhere near the set targets where they need to be. And I think, you know, Eamon Ryan, I suppose, and the Greens would probably point to the fact that they're a minority party in in a three-way coalition, that, you know, there's a limit to what they could have achieved. But I do think if you're any objective analysis of the Green Party under Eamon Ryan, having learnt all the lessons of that 2007 to 2011 period, where they made horrendous mistakes and very amateur mistakes in government, they've been a far more astute, far more effective force in government under Eamon Ryan this time around.
No, I think he's actually one of the most successful politicians of his generation for his agenda. I'm just trying to tease out whether or not the wider interest has been served as a consequence of that. And one of the other issues that I wanted to look at is another thing you've been covering a lot of is a bigger concern about that energy supply that comes from industry. Because you did mention there that, look, he did change attitudes and has changed the conversation about delivering more kind of macro renewable energy, but he hasn't actually done much of it. And that has led to big concerns from big industries, like we've seen from Amazon. Data centres are being affected by what is effectively a moratorium at the moment. Even Gas Networks Ireland concerned about the capacity of our grid to deal with the demand. He might have been successful in driving his own agenda, but what potential cost to industry and potentially corporation tax and then potentially jobs?
That's a huge question, and I think you're absolutely right in highlighting it, because, you know, what we have seen from, I think, the big tech companies and from the likes of Amazon, who, you know, have benefited from Ireland's preferential tax regime and you know, have invested massively here, you know, they have all said Ireland has done extremely well out of, you know, the first, second, third wave of tech, but we're likely to be lost or likely to lose out on the next two or three waves because of this moratorium, because of our, you know, and particularly in the light of AI. AI is going to be a huge focus for a lot of industry all over the world. They're all going to require data centers. They're all going to require infrastructure. And Ireland has essentially sent a message out to the world for the next 4 or 5 years, lads, we're not interested. There's no room at the inn, essentially. And that's a very dangerous message, because we will lose out to other countries of similar size and even bigger, even though we're in the EU, we're English speaking. So I do think, you know, while, as I said, Eamon Ryan can look with pride as to, you know, the shaping the conversation, their big weakness has been in terms of delivery and in terms of actually keeping, or I suppose, matching the rhetoric with activity. I don't think, and our paper has been very strong on this, we don't think, you know, it's been acceptable that we're saying no to all these businesses, because it's the economy that's going to suffer, maybe not this year or next, but certainly going to kind of be affected in 2, 3, 4 years time. And that's a concern for jobs, that's a concern for economic growth, etc. like that. So all of this does have a consequence. You know, even, you know, his insistence on keeping the, or refusing to intervene in the passenger cap at Dublin Airport is one that has become, you know, hugely controversial, because Dublin Airport, as we've argued in the Business Post, is the primary gateway into Ireland. Like, I mean, we're an island nation. I think we have argued that it's economic folly not to be or not to allow the airport increase, because ultimately how are businesses supposed to trade and grow and continue to prosper if we're, you know, shooting ourselves in the foot at a time when we've literally just built a second runway and there's capacity there for up to 60 million passengers. Not to increase the passenger cap, and for his refusal to do so, I do think is a criticism of him, and I certainly have been very vocal in my criticism. So I'm not coming on here issuing a hagiography of Eamon Ryan. We've disagreed on many policies, and the aviation one, I think, I think he could do with being a little bit more pragmatic rather than being more ideological on that front.
Well, we have to see if his successor changed. Danny, before I let you go, and I did want to speak a little bit about the aviation thing, but we've run out of time. But it was this week last year when the whole kerfuffle about RTE started, and I think the year before actually was when the Future Media Commission reported into government. But you mentioned them earlier, and that they haven't, you know, delivered the solutions on that. Do you think that they won't deliver the final decision from government now that he's gone from office? Is that what I'm taking from what you said earlier?
So the government had have continuously promised that a solution in terms of the future funding for RTE would be delivered before the summer recess. I think the fact that Eamon Ryan and Catherine Martin have both signaled they're essentially stepping back puts a doubt over that timeline, because if Roderick O'Gorman or Pippa Hackett decide to change the lineup at cabinet, that obviously would have an impact in terms of delivery. So I do think that there's now certainly an open question as to the timing of that. And certainly, you know, it would be a seismic decision for the government to deliver on that RTE funding model before the summer recess. And there's only about two or three weeks left before the summer recess kicks in anyway. So there isn't a huge amount of time left. But I certainly think, you know, because the leadership of the Green Party is not due to conclude until July 8th anyway. So we have a round of hustings, I presume, and there'll be a kind of that internal party process will have to work itself out. So I don't see an RTE big decision being announced in the midst of a leadership in the midst of a leadership contest, and then what, you've got a week and a half before the sort of doll goes into recess. So the window is tight. So I think that the likelihood of seeing it being kicked to the autumn is probably more likely as of now. But you know, let's just wait and see. But certainly the timeline that the government has certainly set out is running out very, very quickly, and this Green Party leadership contest only complicates matters even further.
Absolutely. Well, look, for now, I think we'll just have to wish Eamon Ryan the very best in his future endeavours. He is an absolute gentleman to deal with, and everybody across the political spectrum will tell you the same thing. Okay, well, we leave it there. That's Daniel McConnell, editor of The Business Post. Thank you very much for joining us today. Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. My thanks, as always, to all of today's guests, and thanks to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy. Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt were on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments about any of today's items, please do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.